Hey, everybody. It's another episode of Her with Amina Brown. And y'all, we are episode 10 this week. Y'all have been rocking with me for 10 weeks. I just want to thank you. Give a hand to yourselves. I just want to thank you. Don't do that if you're driving a car right now. But when you're not driving, give yourself a hand. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening, being here in the Her living room, engaging with me. And please know I post about each of these episodes on social media. So if you are on social media and you are not following me there yet, I would love to see you there. And you can comment and let me know how you are digging the conversations we're having here. And I want to give a special shout out to my people that have been listening before the podcast relaunched, my OG Her listeners. I want to say a big thank you to all of you for your support during this time. 10 weeks, y'all. I'm so proud of us. Also, I'm tired. I'm tired. Are y'all tired? Are y'all tired? Because it's just like a bone deep weariness and fatigue that I experience. And I know I'm not alone. I know that y'all are tired too. Because honestly, we are now at the beginning of the last month of 2020, and we have survived a gang of things this year. We are yet in a global pandemic. We are yet in the middle of a global uprising. We have experienced a lot of upheaval, especially for us here in the States, in our politics, in our election processes, not to mention just all whatever personal stuff you might have going on in your life. Y'all, I'm tired. And I know some of y'all are tired too. And I wanted to start off this episode by speaking to that because I was thinking about the word recovery this week. And as a person who has had some really challenging like health stuff come up in my life in the last 5 or 7 years. And I think I've talked on here already about this. And if I haven't, I'm sure I'll talk about it some more. I had to have a very major procedure a few years ago. And after the procedure, I had 6 to 8 weeks of recovery, right? And since then, every now and then, I will have to have an outpatient procedure, which is not as intense as the surgery was, but the outpatient procedures still require a certain amount of days of recovery. And I want us to applaud ourselves and give ourselves kudos for making it through what has probably been collectively, for a lot of us, one of the most challenging years that we've had personally and collectively, just as our various communities, you know, even those of you that may be listening that don't live here in the States, in whatever country where you live, we've experienced a lot of challenges this year. And that's not even to mention whatever other things you may have just going on in your life as an individual. And I think it's important to allow ourselves space and time to recover. And I know, this time of year is not always a great time of year to recover because even though we are in a pandemic, people have still found ways to fill our social calendars to the hilt with all of the Zoom happy hours that may get converted over into Zoom holiday parties and different things that become sort of a part of our schedules around this time of the year. Some of you I know have children and all of the things that go along with that, with the close of the school year and different things. For those of you that celebrate the holidays, you have the holiday season and all that that requires. And some of us trying to figure out creative ways we're going to engage with our families this year, or some of us figuring out creative ways not to engage with our families, depending on the situation, right? And I try to think about this every time this season comes around. I try to think about ways to not sort of get myself on this train of busyness. And inevitably, there's always some way that the busyness overtook me anyway. But I really, this year, for myself, and I wanted to say this to all of you, it's okay for you to be tired right now. It's okay that you feel weary. It's okay that you feel worn out or spent. I want to hold space for those of you listening that just feel numb, that you've gotten to a place where you just almost don't have the capacity to feel anything because of all of the highs and lows that we've experienced during this time. And I want to encourage you, and I want to encourage myself, let's find some ways to give ourselves some recovery time this month. What does that look like? I don't know. That's going to look different for each of us, but it may look like telling some people no. It may look like some of the invitations that you get to do this or that, just saying, no, I'm not going to do that, or no, our family's not going to do that. It may also mean you're going to disappoint some people. That's a theme that we've discussed here in our Her Living Room, that sometimes other people may be disappointed, but even though we disappoint them, we are taking care of ourselves when we do that. And it's important for us to care for ourselves during this time. And one of the things that I love about this holiday season that we celebrate, and that we celebrate it during sort of this beginning time of winter, one of the things I love about that is we're starting to experience even the stillness of the seasons, right? We're getting to the end of fall. We've seen the leaves fall. For those of you that live in areas where you get a chance to see the trees do that, some of you live in spaces where you're already experiencing snow and ice, but let's take some time for stillness. Let's take some time for recovery. Let's take some time to watch some movies that you love, to think about what are the things that refuel you? What are the things that make you feel alive? For some of us, it could be what are the things that are really going to get you back in touch with yourself. For those of us that have gotten to a place where we just don't feel anything or don't even have the capacity to feel anything, what are the things you can do to get yourself back in touch with who you are and back in touch with what you love? Think about some people that when you talk to them and you finish texting them, or you hang up the phone, or whatever way you communicate, and you always feel more alive after you talk to them, or you always feel more full of joy. And how can you get time with more of those people? And for those of you that refuel yourself by having time alone or having time in the quiet, in the silence, what are some ways you can incorporate that in your life more? Is it maybe taking a drive by yourself, even if it's just running an errand, right? Shout out to some of my parents that are listening, that time is inevitably going to be in the bathroom for you because that's the one place you know you can go. And at least try to avoid your children or some of the other people in your house to have a moment to yourself. For those of my people that love holiday decorations, maybe you have your Christmas tree or your tinsel, your wreaths, whatever your stuff is, how you like to sort of acknowledge, whether it's the holiday, or I know some of you even love to acknowledge the winter solstice, right? What are some ways you can sit in the room where your candles are and turn some of the lights down and just be in a space to think about where you are now, think about the things that some of the hard stuff of this year has taught you. What can you do to bring some joy back into your space? Are there comedians that you can watch? Are there family members or friends that can help you be reminded of the joy in your life? So I just wanted to hold space for that at the beginning of this episode. I want you to know if you're tired, if you're weary, you are not alone. There are many of us who are feeling that same fatigue. And let's get some rest. Let's put that on our agenda. Some of us can have a holiday party of one sometimes if we need to, okay? Just be reminded that it's okay for us to have some time to recover, that when we recover, we rest, we heal, we are reminded about what matters to us. And it is from that type of centeredness, from that type of groundedness, that we can move forward and see what are the other possibilities in our life. So take care of yourself, and let's take care of each other. This week, in an interview from the Her Archives, joining me in our living room is disabled activist, podcast, and founder-director of the Disability Visibility Project, Alice Wong. Listen in as Alice talks about how her creative work informs her activism. Check it out. I always clap, Alice. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted.
So as Alice and I were just chit-chatting before I started recording this, we almost just like jumped into a hole. I was like, let me just press record.
You know, we just fell right into it, as wonderful creative people just do.
That's so right. And actually, I was introduced to you on Twitter, Alice. That's how I started following you and learning more about Disability Visibility Project. And I really have been, I don't know if it's still considered lurking on Twitter, but we used to use that term for other like online things when you just like were on there like in a message board or whatever, and you're not talking there, but you're reading everything, right? So I've been lurking through a lot of your Twitter threads and different Twitter conversations and Twitter parties that you've been having, and just have learned so much from you, Alice. And so I'm really honored to have you.
I lurk as well. As you know, Twitter to be a real, you know, a dumpster fire, right? Yeah. It's horrible, the trolling, the harassment. But on the flip side, this is where I learn a lot from a lot of people. I'm constantly amazed by the amount of labor in terms of education and wisdom. You know, people just telling the truth in their own words in such a public medium that it constantly, you know, I'm just, you know, constantly learning and just, you know, shook. You know, it's just amazing. So, you know, just like you, I think I found and followed lots of interesting people, and I think it's still, there's a lot of value despite, you know, all the things that are not so great about it.
That's true, because there are quite a few things that were like, oh gosh, that's terrible about Twitter. But I have to say, you know, one of the opportunities that we have on a platform like Twitter is we have an opportunity to choose the people that we follow. You know, it's not the same as how like Facebook was when like you've added a person and now there's like a mutual connection between you. Like sometimes you might be following people, they may not even be following you back or even know who you are at all, but you're getting a chance to sort of get this window into some things that you could learn from them. And I think too, and we'll talk about this more when we get to hear more about some of the online community that you've been building. But I think a part of it that's been good for me is putting myself in the posture to listen, especially if I am sitting from a privileged place, getting a chance to just listen. It's not time for me to talk. It's not a conversation for me to add to. It's not my conversation. It's for me to read, listen, learn, support, you know, do those things. So just I really appreciate you, Alice, and I'm glad you are on the podcast to tell us all the things. I'm hoping I won't keep you here for 3 hours and you're like, listen.
Listen, I like you, but I don't like you.
Right. To be clear.
Listen, I gotta hydrate.
That's right. Hydration is important. That is right.
We can always do a follow-up one.
That's true. Okay, that's true. So I'll see how far I get, Alice. And if it gets to where, you know, it's getting long here, I may just have to do a follow-up with you.
Restrain yourself.
Thank you. I will. I'm going to work on it. I'm going to work on it, girl.
I will do as well. I will try.
I love to ask each guest an origin story. And one of the things that I find really inspiring about you as a leader and as a creative is it's like I start like reading your bio, and it's like I've already gone to like 5 different links of things that you've made or created or co-created or spearheaded. You know, you are a very prolific person. You know, like when you think about young Alice, do you have moments you can think of when you were young that you're like, I started out being a creative person early on in life?
Well, I will say there's 2 stories. In kindergarten, I remember we had a project where our teacher had all these kind of wallpaper samples. Yeah, we were supposed to create a book out of, you know, these wallpaper samples as our cover for a book. Then there was this really beautiful, shiny piece of wallpaper that was like silvery, aqua blue, and all these waves. And I remember my eyes just like went right toward it. And I was inspired by that cover because I thought, I'm going to write a book about fish. And then I just kind of you know, maybe some illustrations. And, you know, that was where I think, you know, maybe the gem of, you know, writing and creating something, you know, using colors and design, you know, maybe that's where it started. But I think, you know, at the heart of it, I've always been really into writing in terms of like telling my own stories, making up stories. And I think a lot of this happened because as a disabled child, there were a lot of times growing up where I couldn't participate with a lot of the other kids. So, you know, I didn't play on the playground at recess. There were a lot of activities. And I grew up, you know, the 70s and 80s. That's not a lot of access issues. So I was really often on the sidelines. And nobody thought it was wrong for this to happen, okay? So even I didn't even realize it was a problem. I was always that way. And so I had a lot of time on my hands. And there were a lot of times when I just had my imagination. That was my friend. And I think that that's been one of the biggest assets in terms of growing up disabled in a non-disabled world. Having that perspective and that imagination and time to really think and, you know, have a creativity in terms of imagining what else could be. So I think that's how I became a creative person, but not really too sure. I guess other people would have to, people with Adobe would have to say, like, give their own two cents.
I love that because I think it's some of the phrasing that you used, I think was really interesting when you talked about part of you having an imagination as a disabled child is what was giving you this ability to imagine what could be. And mm-hmm. I think the more we talk about, you know, your work as an activist and as a creator, there's so much of that showing up in your work that a part of how what you're doing is showing up in the world. It's creating things. It's thinking about what could be and making those things so that there are more spaces in the world where the way we imagine it could be, could actually be, which is really powerful, right?
Yeah, and I think as a kid, I've always been, you know, real nerd, loved science fiction, and I think libraries were really my home. So books were, I think, you know, a form of escape, a form of liberation for me. I mean, I felt so alive, so engaged, you know, through reading, and I, you know, it didn't matter that I couldn't go on a camping trip, or it didn't matter that I was left out of this activity because, you know, through my imagination and through reading, I could go anywhere. And that to me was incredibly, you know, radical and liberatory. And, you know, books like The Chronicles of Narnia, Octavia Butler, you know, just...
Yes, Octavia, yes.
Oh, I mean, my mind built it. Like, in high school, when I discovered, oh, I was like, OMG, you know, that was... You know, life-changing, the way books really open your world and worlds. You know, these multiverses and, you know, I think a wrinkle of time. As a young child, that was, for so many people, you know, that was like a gateway. And I am always indebted, I think, to science fiction and fantasy writers to really give us a sense of like, you know, there is the real world, but there's, you know, if we don't think about what can be, it'll never happen. Mm-hmm. And that's why I love Star Trek. And that's why, you know, things like that. It just gives us this hope. And it's just an optimism. It's something to look forward to. Or something to keep fighting for.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you this. Would you say that being a reader growing up inspired you to also become a writer? Because that's a part of my story, too, that I grew up a very introverted kid. So I mean, still today, I sometimes go to public functions and think that I might enjoy reading a book better than being there talking to people. But, you know, there was something about just, you know, my mom and my grandma both being people who love to read. And so there were a lot of those trips to the library and like getting the max amount of books, you know, that I could check out and seeing how quickly I could get them read between then and when, you know, you had to check them back in. And I realize now, although I don't know if I knew this as a child, but I realized now there was something about the reading that made me want to become a writer because I looked at just the power of what, you know, a writer could do. Like one of my favorite series was the Choose Your Own Adventure books. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm so glad they're back in print now, because for a while they went out of print. But I loved those books. Like, just that someone could think not just of one story, but could write a book that had like 76 different endings, you know, like that made me want to try writing. Was that your story too, that it's the reading that led you to also want to write?
Absolutely. I think just see the huge spectrum of storytelling and what's out there. And obviously, you know, I think also, you know, I don't know about you, but I did these summer reading programs at the library where you get like stickers. And I mean, that was just part of my, you know, summers and just growing up and just really loving, like, I remember loving Beatrice Potter. Her illustrations, mm-hmm. really, I mean, they came alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, just having those visuals, like, you know, the Caldecott Award, those are awards for, like, children's books in terms of illustrations.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I remember as a kid, this is how dirty I am, going to and checking out, like, all the Caldecott Medal Award winners. And, you know, just seeing the different illustrations. Because I thought, oh my gosh, like if I like this one, I'm going to look through, you know, all of the award winners. And, you know, again, the power of words plus images really came alive. And of course, you know, that really sparked, you know, whatever, you know, was going on in my little brain.
Oh, I like whenever I would pick a book and then like pick it up and see that Caldecott seal on the front, I just felt like... I felt like I was winning something, like I was winning some award somewhere. I just thought, oh yes, like this makes this book even more special. Like I was already looking forward to reading it and now it's like a Caldecott. Oh, I'm so glad I can share in this nerdiness with you, Alice, because I love those Caldecott books.
Me too. There was like some really amazingly trippy ones. Like I felt like there was one I remember called Arrow to the Sun, where it's like about like, I believe a bit, and it was just like the way they just used the images. Mm-hmm. It didn't need that much, you know, text, but they just told a story in such a graphic nature. Again, this is like a different way to tell stories, like graphic novels, the animation now, comics. You know, these are all just so many different ways for people to express themselves, which is really wonderful.
Ah, so wonderful. Oh my gosh, Alice, yes. I can talk to you about all the book things. Yes. I remember one summer I lived with my grandmother when my mom was in basic training for the Army. And my school had like a summer competition. You know, if you won like 100 books over the summer, you'd get the t-shirt that had like the little bookworm graphic on the front, you know? I mean, you couldn't tell me anything.
Yeah, game on. It's on, right?
Yes, totally. So you have not only written, but you also took on the role of editor for the book Resistance and Hope. It's essays by disabled people, Crip Wisdom for the People. Can you talk about what was the process or maybe the difference in the process between writing and editing, like going from the role of writer to now going into editing? Because to be an editor, and you'll tell me if this is true in my mind, because I've never done this, but in my mind, it seems like it's part curation of bringing the different voices together, of sort of gathering, doing that corralling part, and also like the actual editing process of like going through all the words and everything. So talk more about like, what was that transition like between being a writer and going into being an editor? And why was it important to you to release Resistance and Hope?
Yeah, I think I'll first talk a little bit about kind of the origins of this anthology. So, you know, like a lot of people on the election night of 2016, it was, you know, scary, horrible, you know, soul crushing. And, you know, I was in a panic personally. I knew exactly what kind of future and what this administration would bring, despite, you know, a lot of people saying, oh, you never know, or just, you know, give this person a chance. I'm like, no, you know, like, mostly marginalized communities have been sounding the bell throughout the entire election. And if you weren't listening to them, you know, this is what we have now, because people didn't listen to Black women. People didn't listen to disabled people. People didn't listen to the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was, like a lot of people, just feeling, you know, at a loss about, like, what now? And then I realized You know what? Like, disabled people are just resilient, creative survivors. And it was really interesting to see, you know, the word resistance, you know, pop up a bunch more, you know, in 2016 and how, like, everybody's resisting this and resisting that. And, you know, I realized that there are disabled people who have been doing the work, living this every day, way before this election. And why aren't these voices part of this larger narrative?
Right.
Or this larger conversation? And I really thought about, you know, why do we do what we do? And I think for me, you know, personally, despite all the horror and the distress and trauma and the real, you know, pain of living and fighting oppression, that we continue this work because we have hope. And I thought, okay, resistance and hope, resistance and hope. There's something interesting there in terms of what is the relationship between these two.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to center it within a disabled lens. So, you know, I thought, what can I do as an individual in the response to this administration, in response to this time period we're living in? And, you know, I wrote a few things in the past. I thought, what's another way I could be creative and challenge myself? So I've never done it before. I decided to self-publish and edit an anthology. And I thought, you know, this could be really a gift to the world. You know, this is something that I think I could do that really showcases the people in my community. And it's something that I can release and have it as a tool or as a resource or reference to say, this is where we are now. You know, this is where we want to be. And these are some people that you should be reading and following. So, you know, I thought, okay, let me see if I can do this. This is going to be interesting. I think talking about creativity, I think it's always good to kind of push yourself and do something you've never done before. And, you know, I learned a lot in terms of just what's involved in self-publishing, in terms of an ebook. And it was a great learning process. And I think as an editor, you know, it's all about who you want to include and feature. I think that's like the curation aspect that you said. I think that's almost just like casting, or, you know, once you cast your cast, it creates the product. So just like you, in terms of us knowing each other on Twitter, a majority of people that I invited to submit an essay for this anthology are people that I follow and learn from and deeply appreciate on Twitter. Some of these folks I've never met in my entire life, and I just, you know, like DM them. I'm like, hey, I really appreciated your Twitter threads these last few months. Like, they're just so, you know, full of wisdom. And I was like, do you have any interest in writing a blog for peace? So that to me was really exciting in terms of just putting myself out there and just approaching folks and getting this kind of really interesting cross-section of people that I personally find amazing in terms of just truth tellers, people who I, you know, consider badasses in just every different field. So, like, you know, I was very intentional that I wanted multiply marginalized disabled people. So it might be Muslim disabled people, or just, you know, queer disabled people, trans disabled people, you know, and I basically was very intentional of having pretty much a majority of every contributor to be a disabled person of color. Because I really wanted that to be, you know, just the default.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even use the word intersectional because I feel like that word is almost overused. Yes, if that's appropriated. Like, I just wanted it to be what it is, you know, like that's it. And I want people just to take away from that. Like, this is going to be my door. And I want that to be an example for other folks. But yeah, it's been really fun. And I think being an editor, I learned a lot. You know, I'll be upfront. I'm really bad at grammar. So, like, I hired a copy editor to do that. So that's definitely, you know, things that was really helpful to delegate. But in terms of, like, it's really like a lot of work of editing is really just having the right combination of essays. And, you know, I couldn't be more pleased with what each contributor offered in terms of just what they decided to write about. And just the the trust you have to have towards your contributors. I think that to me was really interesting, that, you know, if you have this trust and faith that your writers will pull through, they usually do. Mm-hmm. And it's been just a thrill to be able to have this. And, you know, I made a point to make sure that this anthology is free and to make it accessible. Yes, that's another form of access that a lot of people don't think about.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. That's so good. And we're talking about curation. I kind of want to also like talk about podcasts in here, because as you were talking about curating the voices and contributors that were in the anthology, and I loved the phrase that you used in there, that you wanted the fact that this was majority voices who were disabled people of color, that you wanted that to be the default. And I was like, oh, yes. Yes, Alice. Like when I heard you use that phrasing, I love that so much, because we want the default to be centering the voices who are most marginalized. That should be our default, that we center those stories, that we elevate those leaders and voices. So you also have a podcast. You are so prolific, Alice. I'm out here looking at my calendar like, I need to make more things, because Alice is out here making some things.
Hey, it's, you know what? It's not a competition. I feel like it's been a lot, but I think I've tried to make things work for me in terms of, if I'm not going to be able to do something, that's okay. I think that's another thing as creators, you and I probably, you know, both go through, is this sense of like, you know, obligation, yeah, or this sense of like, did I feel like we have to forgive ourselves and, you know, try to structure our work in a way that's optimal for us, because otherwise, you know, because we do have some control over our workflow. For example, when I first started out with my podcast, you know, I assumed that, you know, I did it a lot. So, you know, I think I did like 1 a week, my first few months. And I was like, that is way too much for me. I learned from this. I need to make it more doable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, starting, I think, over a year ago, I decided to do 2 episodes a month, which is already a lot, I think. But, you know, I'm not one of those people that has, like, you know, a podcast that's syndicated or anything. It's just me and some audio producers that I work with. And I think this is where, you know, having that consistency is good for the audience. It is good for me.
Yeah.
But doing it in a way that doesn't make me feel like I'm constantly under pressure, because I don't know about you, but I'm in it for the long run.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess, you know, it's totally true that some podcasts have a lifespan, right? Like it's not gonna, you know, it's gonna be sometimes a 1 year thing. And that's totally okay. But, you know, if I start something, I think I wanna try to carry it through as long as it gives me joy, right? Like that's the bottom line. Like I wanna love doing this. I don't want to feel like it's a burden or feel stressed. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try to make it, you know, as, you know, even if it might be like a way that's atypical, like, it's not about you, Mina, but like I plan my episodes really way in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually interview folks. Like, for example, if I interview somebody in April, their episode won't come out until months later, because I like to have that wiggle room. So my podcast isn't going to be, you know, topical in terms of like the latest thing, the latest conversations. And, you know, that's, you know, some podcasts are going to be like that, but mine are going to be about like these evergreen, you know, topics and themes that are always going to be interesting, I think. So that's how I kind of made my choices to really fit with my own abilities, my own strengths, and just making it more manageable for me.
It's such a good reminder hearing you talk about this, Alice, because I am such a like type A personality. I'm very much like sets more goals than can realistically be accomplished in the time that I decided to complete them. Like I'm very much that person. So I'm in the middle of a season of life of really learning the lesson that you articulated so well, that we have to forgive ourselves and give ourselves a lot more grace and just not feel like everything has to be super urgent, you know? So with my podcast, this is my third podcast. My sister-in-law and I have a podcast called Here for the Donuts. That's what I started with. And
you know what? The minute I saw that, I knew it would get your spirits. Because I am a donut lover.
Yes.
Oh, but can we talk about donuts after this?
Yes, please. Like, that's, yeah. Oh my gosh, because donuts are just so amazing. I mean, clearly that's how much I love them, that my sister-in-law and I were like, yeah, we should just start recording this. And so that's what we do on the podcast. We eat donuts and talk about, you know, what we like to call inappropriate things, but they're super appropriate. Super appropriate and great. To some people, they're probably inappropriate, but not to us. We don't care. Whatever it is, you know. And so that's kind of what like got me into it. But because my sister-in-law is a midwife and mom of five kids, and I'm like a traveling performing artist, you know, who has time? It's like, we just have to record as we have time. So some years we were like putting out a bunch of episodes. And then some years it was like a ghost town. Nobody knows what happens. But we agreed at that point, you know, we're going to record this for fun. You know, we're going to record this as we can. We're not going to like turn this into a machine. And then I did a limited edition podcast for my last book, How to Fix a Broken Record. And then I was like, oh, that was only 10 episodes. Oh, I need to do this more. So now my current podcast, really, I'm just in line with you so much in values, because I wanted to have a podcast that can center the voices of women of color. Women of color telling their stories, telling their experiences personally, professionally, just whatever women of color want to say, that this could be a place where I could just galvanize that kind of conversation.
This medium to be whatever you want it to be. I don't know, I have these professional producers, advertisers that, you know, we're going to be on platforms. No, we're going to be, you know, our own individual creative makers and, you know, just putting the work out there. I think that's, you know, already an accomplishment in itself.
Yeah. Talk to me about, I have so many questions about podcasting I'm trying to ask you. I want to know, what was it about the podcast medium that made you want to create there? Because we have a lot of options now as creatives of how we can put our work out, which in a way I love, because it's created a lot more accessibility to the things that we make. You know, it's now it's like, if I have a poem I put out, the 50 people who are there in the audience don't have to be the only people that get a chance to see it or hear it. Now I have a way to share it in some different places. But what was it about podcasting that made you want to use it as a medium? And then what's your process like as far as curating, like who you interview or the topics that you decide to talk about? Like, tell me more about that.
Yeah. So I think, be mindful that, audio content is, inaccessible for some people. And also be mindful that, sounds are privileging, but what ability. I think, there is something about the intimacy of radio and podcasting that's, very unique. You know, you hear people's voices. I think sometimes there's a lot of magic that happens when you're in conversation with somebody. There's a lot of unexpected things that can happen. And it's a lot of, like, discovery. It's like an adventure. Mm-hmm. You know, you can, as an interviewer, prepare as much as you can. But also let it go, right? Like, letting the interviewee be the guide and just be a good listener. You know, really be sure that the spotlight is on the interviewee and just guiding the conversation.
Yeah.
I think that to me is what I find important, is that my podcast is not a vehicle for me. It is a vehicle for the community that I'm a part of. Yeah. The multiple communities that I'm a part of. I think, it's not the same for everybody's philosophy, but that's my philosophy. And I think it's the intimacy. I think that's really, and I think one thing I love about, recorded conversations is that hearing the laughter.
Yeah.
You can write an essay, you can have a Q&A, but you can't write, in parentheses, laughter. So you miss a lot of these other kind of noises that people make, and I think are also express emotions. this is another way of expression. And I think that adds a lot to what's up, the overall story, and also just for the audience too. Like, they're getting something different, just as if this was a video series and they would be able to see us versus hear us versus read the transcript. You know, I think there's just all these different ways of expressing ourselves. And I think podcast is just another, it's one of many modes. And I think it's good to try to, you know, test them out.
Yeah, and be open to seeing what it's going to become. That's kind of my experience podcasting so far too, is that it sort of took me some episodes to figure out, well, what do I want this to feel like? And I had interviewed people in other settings, but what's the frame of how I want to interview people here? And, you know, as we were talking about before we started recording, you know, there's the prep work of, you know, looking into who it is that you're interviewing and how to make the interview feel warm and curious. I feel like that's a part of which maybe I'm just a nosy person, honestly.
I think it's true. I think at the heart of, I think if we talk about creativity yet, you know, I think it's about curiosity and a genuine interest in learning more. And I think that's it's really exciting, is that, you know, you can do the prep work, but you can also, you know, have a lot of, you know, questions and just, you know, ways of really just giving space, which I think is another thing. It's another act of love, I think, that we can show for each other. Like, it's an act of solidarity, it's an act of love, it's a form of access, just giving space.
Yeah. I love that phrasing. I've heard the phrasing holding space. But when you said giving space just now, like, that has even different implications from holding space, because to give space is something very different. And I love that phrasing.
I think that also speaks to kind of, you know, our privilege and our power. And that, you know, as media makers, you know, we do have choices that we can make in terms of who we invite, what we want to talk about. And I think that's a very deliberate choice of who we want to give space to. And I think everybody almost, whether they, you know, whether it's just conversations or just whatever work they do, I think we all actually have that capacity, whether we realize it or not.
Yeah. So Disability Visibility is your podcast. Disability Visibility is also an online community. And I want you to tell me more about that. Tell our listeners more about that, because you are the director and founder of Disability Visibility as an online community. So what was the moment that inspired you to create this online community?
Yeah, thank you for asking. It's kind of funny. I mean, we're going to reach almost 5 years since I founded the Disability Visibility Project, which started in 2014. And this was really, at first, an oral history partnership with StoryCorps. I don't know if you're familiar with StoryCorps.
Yes, familiar.
So they're, you know, national oral history nonprofits, and they collect oral histories from the various communities, and most of the participants have a choice of having their oral histories archived at the Library of Congress. So I went to one of their events, and they talked about partnerships with various communities. And I went up to them, I said, oh, have you ever done one with the disability community? And they said, no, we haven't. And I was like, huh. And, you know, at that time, you know, to back it up in 2014, you know, the Americans with Disabilities Act was going to turn 25th anniversary in the year 2015. Mm-hmm. So the disability community, you know, around that time right before it, was really gearing up in terms of just finding different ways to mark this kind of landmark anniversary and, you know, landmark civil rights law. And, you know, at that time, I was just an individual person, just, you know, wondering, what could I do? You know, I wasn't really affiliated with any, you know, organization. Even at that time, I don't think I even identified as you know, an activist, like with a capital A. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to do something. I thought, okay, why don't I create a 20-year oral history campaign where I encourage people with disabilities to tell their stories at StoryCorps. And, you know, it first started off as that. And I used social media to really get the word out. So that's where the online community kind of promoted to really to happen. And, you know, it just snowballed. I think I really struck a nerve in terms of so many people want to tell their stories. Mm. There's such a void. If we think about disability history, is that even taught in high schools? No, it's not.
Right.
How many people should name, you know, major moments in disability history? And, you know, other than FDR or Helen Keller or Stevie Wonder, like, how many people should name major people in disability history? So this is a way, I think, of honoring ourselves and to say, this is history now in the making. Right, this is the zeitgeist of like where the disability community is now. And, you know, the idea is not just the big names, but really the stories of everyday people. Because
yeah.
I feel like, you know, we all are creating history, whether we realize it or not. And I think that's another thing. Like, we don't value our own history until later on.
Mm-hmm.
And for so long, with so many, you know, marginalized communities, our stories are not told by us.
Right.
They're often told by historians or other people that just, you know, use our work or just use our words. Like, clearly, they're seeing us through their lens.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to give us a way to tell our stories in our own words and have it to be a really, like, you know, active, participatory, empowering kind of experience. And I'm kind of proud to say that, you know, as of this year, we had over 100 oral histories.
Wow.
Recorded, and I do believe a majority of them are at the Library of Congress, so that anybody could go in there. Millennia later, centuries later, they're going to be there for all time. And that, to me, makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't happen without people wanting to do it. I think that's, you know, it didn't even matter if I had a great idea, but if it wasn't something that resonated strongly mm-hmm. with the disability community, you know, it would have never, you know, be what it is today. So, you know, I just want to say how much gratitude I have in terms of just the way it's been received and the way that people just seem to really, you know, appreciate it.
Yeah. Wow. I love the idea of the importance of preserving the oral history and hearing more disabled history. That's such a powerful thing. And you also are the creator of a hashtag, Crip the Vote. Yes?
Yes.
So I want to, as just in hearing more about how disability visibility, you know, started out as this, you know, put this word out there to get more oral histories from the disabled community, which that ask in and of itself creates more community, right? Which is just amazing mm-hmm. to hear. You also talk a lot about the importance of civic engagement and mm-hmm. use this hashtag Crip the Vote to encourage more discussion about civic engagement in the disabled community. Like, tell me more about, like, what has been your experience as you are leading and initiating these types of conversations among the disabled community? Why is it important? And I'm asking you a question I know a little bit of the answer to from my own experience, but I think we're in a time that we're understanding the importance of civic engagement and understanding the importance of resistance. I just want to hear your perspective. Why is it important to you that the disabled community is engaged in the process of government and in activism?
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of things to say about this because, you know, just like every issue is a woman's issue, I think of every political issue as a disability issue. And I think that's, you know, another thing that a lot of non-disabled people do not understand is that disabled people are part of every single community. Every single issue should be seen as a disability issue. And the fact that we, like many other communities have been left out, excluded, and face multiple barriers in terms of not just voting, but other forms of political participation. You know, there's a history of, you know, outright oppression and discrimination of, you know, actual barriers, just physical and, you know, policy barriers. And, you know, several decades ago, people with disabilities often did not even have the choice of living in a community. You know, I think people kind of forget that. You know, disabled kids were segregated in different classrooms. So it's come a long way, but I don't think we're anywhere near, you know, parity in terms of the power that we deserve, political power, that's a voting, you know, that's a community of voters.
Yeah.
Also, political representation, right? And I think that's what's really, you know, important, that duly elects people who are in the major powers, major positions of power, need to reflect all of us. Yeah, we are not there yet, but this is, you know, the way to get started in terms of just encouraging people to say, yes, we all have a stake in this. And yes, apathy is a huge problem. I myself sometimes feel like, you know, I can throw my hands up and be like, you know, this shit is too hard.
Right.
Or like, what is the point? Like, sometimes it does feel like everything is corrupt and the system is broken. And the system does not work for us, which is actually true to some respect. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we have to think about what are the tools at our in front of us. Well, you know, for some people, voting is still one of the most basic things that you could use. For those who can't vote, who are eligible to vote. Yeah. I mean, let's not forget there are people who still, you know, whether, you know, because they've been in prison or for other reasons, they're disenfranchised with voting. So that, again, itself is not, voting is not the only thing, but it is something that a lot of people have access to. There's also just being involved in your local community, just showing up to meetings, or whether you want to serve on a committee, or even, I think, even online activism is incredibly powerful. I think, you know, I do feel like Twitter and, you know, social media really is like one of my environments I'm the most comfortable in. It's where I feel most alive and most active, because I feel like there's a way of, I think, sparking conversations through hashtags, through, you know, Twitter chats, that can really reach people in ways that traditional forms of organizing, you know, cannot. And I think they're complementary.
Yeah.
Right? Not either or. It's not saying one is better than the other. I think there's value in all kinds of activism. And I'm just using what is at my hands, at my disposal, in a really, hopefully, savvy way to really talk about these things in a very public media so that other people can see it. Other people can join and listen and just learn. And I think having it out there is already something really important. So CryptoVote really started with my two friends, co-partners, Andrew Polrig and Greg Baratet. And we were just three friends who, you know, we've never met in person once.
Wow.
Yeah, they're both based in New York, and we've been just really good friends online. And I think, again, this speaks to, you know, the times we live in, where online friendships are just as real, just as potent as the people we talk to in front of us. And for a lot of disabled people who either can't get out of the house, who are sick, or just, you know, this is the world that we are part of, that this is how we find each other. This is how we connect. And it's really been a form of access for a lot of people. So, you know, the three of us were just people that were intensely interested in politics. You know, we followed the elections. And we thought, hey, you know, since that we formed it right before the 2016, the start of 2016, when there were like just a ton of candidates, and none of them were really talking about disability. And yeah, we were like, why are we always left out? You know, you never see, you rarely see a person's platform, a candidate's platform, talking about the disability community. Mm-hmm. You rarely see us as a community that is, you know, reported by candidates. Why is that? And, you know, I think this is another really interesting question, because why aren't we being considered when we think about all the diverse communities? As this diversity is such a buzzword that everybody's just trying to chase. They try to look woke, and you know, very often this disability community is just an afterthought. And so, like, try to attack on sometimes. And so somebody says, "Hey, what about us?" Then they'll be like, "Oh, okay, like, of course." So there's something interesting about that. That there's such a, we're not even on the radar.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the what's great about Twitter is that you can't make a ruckus, you know, you can't cause noise, and that's the actual power. You know, sometimes it is for creating community, but it's also about mobilizing communities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think having a hashtag is, you know, it belongs to everyone. You know, I think, you know, we use it for our chats, we live tweet, like, debates and, you know, conventions during election years. And, you know, it's for everyone to use who wants to talk about disability issues. And that's exciting, too, that, you know, it doesn't belong to Andrew, Craig, and me. Mm. It's now a thing into itself.
Mm.
So it feels really great that that's, you know, anytime I see people using it, I was like, wow, like, this is it, it feels good. Like, it's like, wow. So, yeah, I think that's really gratifying about using hashtags, and which really becomes a space in itself, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
A place for people to converge,
mm-hmm.
and to meet.
Mm. There are so many powerful things that you just said. The tough part about interviewing people for your podcast is, like, I want to have like a little notebook over here to the side where I could like scribble my stuff, but then the whole recording would sound like, because I'd be over here writing things. But I thought it was so powerful the way you gave us the both and there, because if we're going to affect change, I think there can be this temptation to be like, oh, well, the only way we affect change is if we do it this way, or the only way to affect change is if we do it that way. And just affecting change is accessible to all of us. Mm-hmm. And there are ways and steps that we can take, things that we can do, you know, that can help us all as a community work together.
Yeah, and I think this is why, like, you know, activism needs to be redefined, because I think sometimes, you know, there are some activists, like, there's one way to do this, or this is the, yeah, you know, to be an activist, you have to, like, you know, put your body on the line and mm-hmm. sacrifice this. And no, that's not true. I mean, and I think that actually drives people away from wanting to get involved, right? Because they have this very specific idea, because the images and stories we see about activists and activism is somewhat narrow, right?
Yeah.
So it's not just about these rallies and marches, you know, wearing these signs and the pussy hats. You know, I really believe that, you know, even sharing information is a form of activism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be affiliated with anybody to be an activist. You could just, you know, do stuff on your own and just do it quietly. You don't need a megaphone. You don't need to even identify as an activist to be an activist.
Mm.
You know, even I myself, I think, was really reluctant. You know, I mentioned this earlier, to think of myself as an activist, because I was worried that, you know, people would not see me that way or don't believe me. And I think that's, again, this really weird kind of orthodoxy, right? That it's like, to be a real activist or to do the real work, you have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of the weird kind of ableist ideas too, right? That if you're not putting the time and energy or being physically in a space, like, somehow you're not making your voice heard.
Right.
And that's not true. There's a lot of ways to make your voice heard. Mm-hmm. And I think we all need to really be much more mindful and accepting of all kinds of activism.
Mm. A word today from Alice Wong. A word.
Yeah, know it.
Since this interview, Alice has continued her activism by amplifying disability media and culture. And for her most recent book, she is the editor of the anthology Disability Visibility, First Person Stories from the 21st Century, published by Vintage Books in June 2020. Make sure you get a copy of the book, and you can learn more about Alice's work by following her on Twitter at SFDirewolf and following Disability Visibility Project at DisVisibility on Twitter. And you can get more information at disabilityvisibilityproject.com. And of course, all of these links and more links to different things in my conversation with Alice will be available on the show notes. You can find those at aminabrown.com/herwithamina. And if you are not already following me, and I hope you are, but if you are not, I would love to be your friend on social media. I am at Amina B. That's Amina B-E-E on Twitter and Instagram. I'd love to be your friend. For this week's edition of Give Her a Crown, I want to give a special shout out to makeup artist Grace Ahn. This year, I'm one of the faces of Olay's Face Anything campaign. And this summer, I had my first photo and video shoot for the campaign. Grace was the makeup artist that did my makeup, and we had a special connection because she also did the makeup for the phase 2 video and photo shoot for Tracee Ellis Ross's natural hair care brand Pattern. I am the poetic partner for Pattern, so I wrote the poetic piece that was used at that shoot. So even though Grace and I hadn't met each other until the Olay shoot, it felt like we already had the chance to collaborate. Grace's amazing makeup artistry has taken her all over the world, where she worked with fashion brands such as Christian Dior, Fendi, Ralph Lauren, and many more, as well as having her work featured in Vogue, Elle, New York Times, and many other magazines across the globe. Grace, you're not only a phenomenal makeup artist, but you are also a wonderful human. Grace Ahn, give her a crown. Her with Amina Brown is produced by Matt Owen for Soul Graffiti Productions as a part of the Seneca Women Podcast Network in partnership with iHeartRadio. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast.